Hello.
Hey.
You're listening to Peninsula Obscura. I'm Karina Kolb.
And I'm Rachel Peacock.
This is a podcast about the strange and unusual state of Florida.
We'll talk about Florida's weird history,
paranormal activity,
and of course, true crime.
Each week, one of us researches a topic, and then we talk about it in depth.
Let's dive in.
Welcome back.
Welcome. Welcome to our madness. I guess we're not mad. We're just a little weird. I don't know what kind of opening this is, but here we are. I told you to eat some ice cream at the end of last episode. I should have brought some today to eat while I'm listening. It's been a long day, guys.
It's been a long day. I agree. It's been
a long year. It's January.
Oh boy, has it been. If you're listening now, I can only assume you've listened to part one of this story of Harry and Harriet Moore.
Yep, we hope so.
If you haven't listened to part one, go ahead and pause this episode and go listen to part one, because you need all the context.
Yes, you do.
And fair warning, it's an upsetting story that will only continue to upset you in this episode.
It's a story that I'm glad Karina's telling, but also I'm sad. And I'm ready to hear more sad things. I mean, I hope they aren't sad, but you know, when you talk about murder, it's always going to be sad.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the reality of true crime stories.
Yep.
They're bummers. In 99% of the time.
It's a true bummer.
Well, before we start, let me once again cite my primary source for these past two episodes. Before his time, The Untold Story of Harry T. Moore, America's First Civil Rights Martyr by Ben Green. All of the sources and reference material can be found on our website, so you can check that out. So we left last week's episode on a bit of a cliffhanger. In one awful act, Harry and Harriet Moore became America's first martyrs of the civil rights movement on Christmas Day, 1951. But how did it happen?
Yeah.
The bomb was planted under the house, which was lifted, like many houses in Florida, to let the cool air flow under the roof.
So, I didn't know that's why.
To let the cool air flow under the floor.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's like a lot of older houses in Florida, see that they're raised up. They're not just on like concrete foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because it's before air conditioning, so you want to maximize the coolness of the space. A person easily could crawl under a house, you know, without a problem.
Yes.
The explosion was so powerful that it shattered light fixtures throughout the home.
Oh, my God.
The front windows were blown off and the porch crumbled. Harry and Harriet's bedroom was at the source of the explosion. Instead of floor, there was a huge hole buried under floorboards and furniture. Harry and Harriet lay at the bottom. In fact, many people said that the bomb was planted directly under Harry's bed. Peaches runs to the back door and calls for her uncles, George and Arnold, who live nearby. Both Harry and Harriet are conscious at this point, but delirious. George and Arnold lift them out of the hole and bring them to George's car. It was 35 miles to the nearest hospital.
Oh, my God.
And
remind me that what year this is.
This is the 50s. This is 1950. Okay. Well, this is the the very tail end of 1951.
Okay.
And it's there's a small town.
Not a lot of hospitals around.
There's not a lot of hospitals, exactly. There was an ambulance service, but it was for whites only.
Oh, okay.
So the family knew that they would have to make the drive themselves. It's the middle of the night. It's, you know, 10 p.m., foggy.
It's Christmas.
Christmas Day. They pack Harry and Harriet into George's car, and they leave the house behind and race through the night towards Sanford.
Oh, okay.
Where the hospital was. By 10:45 p.m., Mims, Florida is abuzz with people talking and speculating about what happened. Only after word of mouth spread about the Morris household were the police called in. So, like, no one knew what it was. People thought, you know, people thought that because they're near Cape Canaveral, that, like, a rocket space shuttle. Yeah, exactly. Something had exploded in the sky. Huh. They thought that, you know, some underground generator had exploded. They had no idea what was going on. So the police weren't called right away, and the Moores didn't call the police. They just left and went to the hospital. So the Brevard County Sheriff arrived, Sheriff Williams, who is referred to as a, quote, anomaly for a Southern sheriff in the book before his time. Quote, he never wore a gun and had a sterling reputation in the local Black community. He was equally well-liked in the white community. The author continues, quote, when he walked up on the Moore's porch, he was visibly angry and cursing out loud. Hey, Bill, you better watch out. There might be another bomb, a man cautioned. Let it blow me to hell, Williams replied.
Wow.
So he's upset because this is his community that he's supposed to protect. The Moore family made it to the hospital in a record 35 minutes. Wow. So they are...
They hauled it.
Yes, they're hauling ass. When they arrived, George immediately grabs a stretcher for Harry and orders a nurse to call Dr. George Stark, the only Black physician in Sanford.
Wow.
However, by the time the doctor arrived, it was too late. Harry Moore was dead.
Oh.
Sheriff Williams was looking at a murder investigation, though he didn't know it yet.
Just senseless, man.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Back at the scene of the crime, the sheriff had brought in a bloodhound to find a trail. When led to the explosion site, the dog immediately picks up a scent, which everyone's very excited to buy.
Yeah.
The dog leads the deputies to a grapefruit tree 50 feet away, then to a palm tree in front of the house, then 200 feet away in the Moore's orange grove.
Oh my God.
Basically following the path of whoever planted the bomb, who's
wow.
probably at this point, you know, running from shadow to shadow, trying to hide behind wow. wherever he can. So there were footprints all around the trees at each stop. But the deputies had carelessly trampled most of them.
Ugh.
Leaving only three or four usable footprints as evidence.
Oh, I mean, this is the 50s, so they don't really...
Yeah, I mean, that's... It's hard. I don't want to discredit and assume that everyone is intentionally doing their job poorly, but they don't have super advanced, you know, forensics knowledge.
Yeah.
Though I would assume you would think I should save these footprints. We should reserve the footprints.
Yeah.
Regardless, the dog led them out of the grove and out towards the highway where the scent ended.
Oh.
Indicating that a getaway car was used to escape the scene. So it kind of paints a picture of someone pulling up from the highway, parking at the end of the orchard, and slinking through the orchard all the way to the Morris house. And
then setting the bomb off.
Yeah,
and then...
crawling under and setting the bomb off.
Wow.
When the deputies arrived back at the Morris house, the scent gone cold, George was waiting for them with the news of Harry's death. So everything's happening so fast. Harry Moore dies at midnight of Christmas Day, and George immediately goes back to gather some of his important belongings, his you know, birth certificate, that kind of stuff, and tells the police that he's died. At this point, the crowd has grown, and word spread quickly in the small neighborhood. So deputies begin their questioning of the crowd of neighbors. They ask everyone, why would someone want to kill Harry Moore? And again, people answered, because of the Groveland case.
Wow.
Everyone knew. Yeah. Everyone knew.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big deal.
It was, exactly. It was national news. A small community where everyone knows who Harry Moore is. Mm-hmm. They know what he's passionate about. And there's no question that it was an act of malice around this case, right?
Yes.
Sheriff Williams was asking about what caused the blast. None of the witnesses could agree. Some said they smelled dynamite. Others did not. What Williams did know that the mention of Groveland meant something big and out of his jurisdiction. He had been working all night, and by 3:40 a.m., Williams made a call to the FBI.
Wow.
I think it's pretty clear that he's out of his league. I mean,
yeah.
He doesn't, has no idea what even was the bomb made out of.
And his guys, like, walked all over the footprint.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it is a small town and they don't have a lot of resources, so.
Exactly. And you might think, well, wow, he called the FBI, like, really quickly. But actually, he had, like, a close relationship with the FBI officers in his district. Mm. I guess there's officers assigned, I mean, maybe at the time, officers assigned to different parts of the state. So wow. These were, like, in the Daytona district. Okay. And the reason that he knew them so well is because Cape Canaveral was right there. So anytime anyone, you know, teenagers vandalized something or, you know, hopped a fence, trespassed, it's suddenly a federal crime because it's NASA.
Mm.
So FBI is the people who deals with it.
Yeah, totally.
So they actually had a close working relationship, and that's why he called them so soon. I mean, besides the fact that, you know, Groveland is involved, a team of a dozen agents were put on the case. They began sifting through the dirt under the Moore's house for clues, and they gathered samples in jars to send away for testing. They made casts of the few intact footprints in the grove, which were determined to be size 8 or 9 shoes worn by a tall man or a man with a long gait.
Hmm.
They took photos and interviewed neighbors, friends, family, and any associates of the Moors.
Okay. They're doing their thing.
Yeah, so they hit the ground running, and this bombing sent out shockwaves across the country. I mean, it was the murder of a married couple in their own home on Christmas Day. Yeah. I mean, it is the most
hateful crime.
It's an absolutely hateful crime. And at the time, you know, the people of the country were fully shocked and appalled by it.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first NAACP official ever killed in its 42-year history.
Wow.
And this was basically putting the state of Florida in a spotlight. A very, obviously, very negative spotlight. Yes. And it was even making international news.
Wow.
Everyone was making the connection, too, between the Groveland rape case and, of course, Sheriff Willis McCall.
That bastard.
Yes. And even though other parts of the country were making that connection and recognizing McCall as a villain, he was very widely popular among his community of people.
Yeah.
And even amidst all of this controversy, he ended up getting reelected.
Wow.
As sheriff during everything.
He's an idiot.
Yeah.
Well, not an idiot. He's just...
He's worse than an idiot.
He's a
a villain.
Stupid little shit. And get what he deserves. That's all I have to say. I don't know what happens, but.
Well, reporters descended on the town, and as the FBI continued to investigate, a neighbor reports that he saw a car speed past his house after the blast. And after sharing this with reporters, the neighbor received a threatening phone call telling him that he's talking too much.
Oof.
Rumors spread quickly around town about who could have been involved. Locals, you know, so many different suspects that people were just saying, well, I saw this guy trying to get rid of a pair of size 8 shoes. And, you know, I saw this guy parked outside of the neighborhood and all kinds of rumors. But the FBI was saying nothing in detail about the investigation. They were not addressing rumors. They were fully closed-lipped.
Mm.
People, which is interesting to me because, I mean, if you think about, like, we talked about the Gainesville Ripper in our very first episode. There was a lot of rumors going around, but and the FBI got involved because it was a serial killer.
Yep.
But one of the first things that they did was address rumors. I mean, of course, this is the 90s, so it's like 40 years later. So I would hope they would learn from their mistakes. But the fact that the FBI was just letting the rumors spread is not a good sign.
Yeah. I mean, because I guess the rumors are spreading all over, but in the town they were at, there wasn't that many people. So maybe it wasn't, they were really focused on what they were doing.
Yeah. I mean, it was, it's true. It was like a town of 1,000 people, but.
And maybe it wasn't part of their procedure yet because they're very secretive. I feel like the FBI way back when, probably not to be like whatever, but to judge, I guess. But like, you know, they probably didn't have a procedure for that and they didn't really care if there was rumors spreading, you know?
So they did not have their shit together for a case like this.
Yeah.
So obviously it's kind of a shit show, right? And people across the country at this point were protesting, writing letters, editorials, urging President Truman, J. Edgar Hoover, and Florida Governor Fuller Warren to bring the killers to justice. It's to a degree where it's not just the civil rights activists who are raising outrage. It's most of the nation, or anyways, other people across the country that they feel a little bit more beholden to. You know, some people using their privilege and status to turn the spotlight on this case, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, this is the first assassination of its kind. This is before MLK. This is before, I mean, this is very early on in civil rights history. So it's exploding.
Wow.
For lack of a better term.
Yeah.
Shit
just got real.
Exactly.
Across the nation.
And Governor Fuller Warren is a controversial figure in this story because, like I said, the Florida Terror had been going on and he'd basically been ignoring it, not really acknowledging that it was happening until it started to affect tourism. And his special investigator that he put on this case sparked controversy when it was revealed to the press that he was a former member of the KKK.
What the fuck?
Which obviously is a massive problem for a number of reasons. But most importantly, that the Klansmen in the area were the prime suspects in this bombing and murder.
Oh, God.
And, I mean, it's, he, you know, when questioned, says that he is not a part of the KKK, but wouldn't confirm that he had never been a part of it. And it's kind of like, once a Klansman, always a Klansman. I mean.
Yeah. It's like, obviously, you're going to say you're not a part of it. But if you don't deny that you used to be a part of it, that's going to make you look worse.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's.
Yeah, because if you're like, oh, well, I've changed and blah, 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 maybe some people will believe you, but he's stupid.
So that was incredibly controversial. 6 months pass and there are still no arrests.
No, too long of a time.
Yeah, this, I mean, and considering how much press this has gotten and how much time and resources have been apparently allocated for this,
yeah,
nothing has come of it. The failings of the FBI were receiving criticism from all directions. J. Edgar Hoover was known for boasting that the FBI, quote, always get their man. But it seemed when it came to protecting African Americans, they were failing to deliver on that promise.
Oh, wow.
A grand jury heard testimony on all of the Florida bombings from the Florida Terror, including the murders of Harry and Harriet Moore, but their murders remained unsolved. The grand jury placed blame on the Orlando area Klan in particular, as it was known to have it out for Harry Moore. Newspaper clippings about Moore had apparently been read at meetings, and a floor plan of his house had been shared among Klansmen. Wow. So that seems like a lead.
Yeah.
They did identify two suspects, both members of the Klan. Earl J. Brooklyn, who had a reputation for being exceedingly violent and was previously expelled from a Klan in Georgia for engaging in, quote, unsanctioned acts of violence.
Oh.
Yikes. So if the Klan kicks you out,
you gotta be for bad. Being
too violent, that's a nightmare.
Yeah, that's...
The other suspect was Tillman H. Belvin, who was also reported to be a violent member of the Klan and a close friend of Brooklyn. A witness told the FBI that they had seen both men asking about the Moore's address. Another suspect, Joseph Neville Cox, killed himself after two interviews with the FBI.
Ooh, not... He knew something.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting.
The closer the investigators got, the more their case started to crumble. Mm. Though the suspects and their Klan activities were well known, public even, no one was talking. Eyewitnesses suddenly refused to testify or backpedaled on their claims. And eventually, Belvin and Brooklyn, the two main suspects, died. Both of natural causes.
Wait, so how long did this go on before nothing?
They were never suspects.
I guess they didn't do it, or they didn't find evidence enough against
them. Whatever they had, they couldn't use or wouldn't use. Yeah. There's no explanation for it given.
Okay.
That December, so this is already 6 months later. So then basically a year later, Brown versus the Board of Education ascended to the Supreme Court. And the following year, Rosa Parks would refuse to give up her seat on a city bus in Alabama. The civil rights movement would be born, and the Moore case would slowly fade out of the public eye.
Wow.
But Evangeline and Peaches Moore couldn't forget. Their parents' murderers were still out there walking free. And that's what happened. Everyone forgot about it.
That's so depressing. Karina.
It's not the end of the episode, but that is what happened for a very long time.
Wow.
25 years later, a memorial service was held on the anniversary of the Moore's bombing. As a result of the renewed publicity for the case, as well as pressure from the NAACP, Brevard County Sheriff Roland Zimmerman reopened the case, hoping that people who might not have been willing to talk back then would be willing now. So the case gets reopened 25 years later.
Wow.
1 week later, a man named Edward L. Spivey called investigators. He was dying of cancer and apparently wanted to get something off his chest. Spivey was a Klansman. In 1935, he had been one of the nine indicted for a brutal murder of Joseph Shoemaker, a white labor organizer in Tampa. Now, he was calling about the murder of the Moores. The author of Before His Time, had access to a recording of the conversation, which he says is chilling. He writes, quote, "He told a story about a man named Joseph Neville Cox, who had come to Spivey a few days after the bombing and admitted he had done it. Cox, the secretary of the Orlando Klan, told Spivey he had been paid $5,000, which he used to pay off his home mortgage. He was frightened because the FBI had questioned him about the bombing. Just a few days after that conversation, Cox shot himself." End quote.
Wow.
So
wait, was he the one that
he was the
himself?
One that I mentioned earlier, one of the the suspects.
One of the suspects that killed himself?
Yes.
Wow.
So this guy, Spivey, decides to get that off his chest. Despite some skepticism, Spivey's story did check out. You know, he was saying stuff that aligned with the timeline, and Cox had been interrogated twice, and he also completed suicide without leaving a note or explanation.
Hmm.
That's interesting to investigators. Obviously, this is stuff that's lining up. This is a new lead, and essentially confession that they hadn't heard before. Officers thought that Spivey had also been at the house when Cox planted the bomb, but they never prosecuted. Because as I said, this guy was a Klansman too. Yeah. Or,
and he knew this other guy, obviously.
Yeah, and it kind of is like, well, why does he desperately need to get someone else's crime off his chest?
Yeah.
Because he's still racist. I mean, he's still awful. The author has some quotes from him that are horrible. So you'll have to read the book to read them, because I'm definitely not repeating them.
No, thanks.
I
mean, I'd like to read the book, but I don't want to hear him, really.
Yeah.
I believe you.
So, yeah, they never prosecuted him. I don't know if they didn't have anything on him or what, but... And also, Spivey refused to testify and told investigators that he only talked because he, quote, wanted to get right with his maker before he died. And he did die a few months later.
Wow.
And his confession was added to the files on the case. And the sheriff who had reopened the case, Roland Zimmerman, lost his reelection bid. So the case was closed again.
Wow. Well, at least I got a little bit more information, but still not enough, because...
And, yeah, no justice was served. No one was charged. No one was prosecuted. The case has been reopened 3 more times since the 1970s.
Wow.
In 1991, Florida's governor ordered a new investigation. Though Klan informants reportedly cooperated with the investigation, it did not result in any indictments.
Hmm.
In 2004, the Florida Attorney General ordered another investigation. They interviewed over 100 people, but came to the same conclusion that the 4 previously suspected men had carried out the bombing and all were deceased. In 2008, the FBI came to the same conclusion, and in 2011, another attempt to reopen the case. During that 1999 investigation, Sheriff Willis McCall was questioned about the murders. There was a suspicion that he had been the financial source behind the $5,000 paid to Cox. From a New York Times article from that year, quote, "Asked about accusations that he had bankrolled the Moore assassinations, Mr. McCall said with a smirk, 'I would have, but I didn't have that kind of money.'" End quote. McCall, by that time, had been the subject of 50 other investigations. And in this case, he declined the request for a polygraph test. But since the investigators could come up with no real evidence against him, he was dropped as a suspect.
I'm rolling my eyes.
And again, the frustrating thing about this is it's so easy to say, oh, the 4 people who did it, they're all dead. No problem. Sorry. No justice served.
Yeah, but that seems so like, it's like, why don't I blame someone? Why don't we let it lie where it is? Because these people are dead. They, if they did it, or if
and the real
people
question
that did
is,
it are just blaming it on the people that are dead, then exactly. Where's the justice?
And were these four people acting independently? No.
No.
Cox got paid for something.
Well, were they younger people or no? Are they like middle-aged men?
I think they were relatively young at the time because they were alive in the 70s. Well, most of them were dead by the 70s. Yeah. So
it's just
they were middle-aged probably. So,
but it seems like because those people were lower profile in, well, you said one of them was, no, they talked to a secretary. It wasn't actually.
No, one of them was the secretary. So they were all in the Klan. Okay. To be clear, they were all in the Klan,
but I mean, the secretary would be kind of higher up.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I was going to say, like, because it's such a high profile attack and planned, and they had the Orlando plans. KKK had the floor plan of their house.
Yeah.
It just seems too planned. It's not just those four guys. Yeah, I mean, it's someone telling someone.
The KKK doesn't have four members.
They have a meeting and they say, you know what I want to do? I want to be so hateful on Christmas and I want to kill some people that I hate. And I'm not going to use bad words because.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, again, like, it's just, there weren't four members of this organization who paid Cox $5,000. There's a lot of unanswered questions that can't really be wrapped up by, well, the four people who did it are dead. So
yeah,
have a nice life, you know? So from the History Channel's article about the murders, quote, "Today, the Christmas Day bombing is thought of as the first murder in the civil rights movement. Years before figures like Martin Luther King Jr. or Medgar Evers were killed, the Moors paid the price for their activism. The investigation of their deaths followed a pattern that had been set for centuries. Instead of helping ferret out the murderers, white Southerners rallied around the perpetrators. Few came forward to give information that could help build a case, even when the perpetrators' identities were known." End quote.
Hmm.
So, I mean, there you have it. Like I said, Sheriff McCall was very popular in his community and got reelected.
Yeah, but his community was probably mostly people.
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm talking about
the white racists.
The white people. Yeah, no,
they loved him. Yeah, I can't.
And that's what happened. I mean, people closed ranks and shut their mouths and did nothing, and that's why nothing happened.
Oh,
I told you this was a bummer.
Yeah,
but
I mean, it
there
sparked
is something. To
a lot
to get out of this story, you know.
Yeah,
it's not just a sad story. It is there's a message, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think most importantly, there's a message to not idly stand by when injustice is done, you know.
Yes.
Moore's the Moore's youngest daughter, Evangeline, died at the age of 85 in 2015.
Wow.
So she lived a long life in her parents' legacy, and she fought her whole life for justice for her parents and for them to be remembered as the civil rights leaders that they were. If they can't have the justice that they deserve, their story should be told and remembered. I'd like to close this with an excerpt from a poem by Langston Hughes titled "Ballad of Harry T. Moore," which he wrote the year after the bombing. "When will men forsake of peace and for democracy? Learn no bombs a man can make keep men from being free. It seemed that I hear Harry Moore from the earth his voice cries. No bomb can kill the dreams I hold, for freedom never dies."
Whew. Wow.
And that's the story of Harry and Harriet Moore, America's first civil rights martyrs.
Thank you for telling it. That was crazy and important to everyone.
Yeah, it's important to think about and to talk about. And
yeah,
it's an opportunity to reflect on the present and on what the Moors did for their community and for America.
Yeah.
And it's important not to forget them. I think that, you know, stories with happy endings are often the ones that get told more often, but life doesn't have happy endings.
No. And I think it's a good message of humans are humans and everybody needs to just fucking get along. I really appreciate the person who wrote this book, you said.
Yes.
Where you got your information
his
from.
His name is Ben Green and his book is much more detailed than my story here. And he used, you know, first person accounts from people. He interviewed people. He got access to the FBI files, which is how he listened to that recording.
Dang.
So it's a really in-depth book. And it also lays down kind of the environment of the time, what else was going on for civil rights in Florida, what other pieces of the puzzle were moving.
Yeah, the Florida Terror, all this other stuff. Wow.
So I recommend it. I got it from the library. Support your public libraries. But yeah, that's it. I don't want to end on a miserable note. That's why I chose to end it with the poem.
It's a nice poem.
It's ultimately a hopeful poem. It's called The Ballad of Harry T. Moore by Langston Hughes. If you want to read the whole thing, it's available online. But yeah, that's it.
That was sad but cool and dope in the timeline of American history. And I'm like, I'm gonna be telling everybody about this story.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, maybe I shouldn't tell everybody. Like, I shouldn't be walking around the grocery store being like, "Hey, you want to hear about two murdered African Americans that were super important in history? I bet you didn't know about that." I did last week on my personal Instagram. I made a poll.
Oh my god, yeah.
Because I usually share the episode on my story. And I made a poll to see how many people actually have heard about the Florida Terror. But basically, I got a little bit of feedback. Some people just skip through and obviously don't care about important history. But so 83% of people that did my poll basically said that they have never heard of it.
Honestly, that's a smaller number than I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be like 100%.
Yeah.
Had they listened to the episode?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Interesting.
Anyways, yeah.
All right, well,
I hope you also have some more ice cream this time around because bummers. And you maybe have a nice bath or self-care, face mask, reflect, journal, do whatever you do. Listen to another one of our episodes. We already said this last time, but Podcare.
You know. Podcare.
All right. Well, we'll see you. Well, I guess we won't see you, but we look forward to talking again next week for you.
Okay, that's it.
Stop listening.
Over. Bye. Stop listening. All the music for our podcast is provided by The Murmurs and their album Get Swell Soon. You can listen to The Murmurs on Spotify or find them on their Bandcamp page.
If you're interested in learning more about us, you can visit our website at peninsulaobscura.com and check out our Instagram at peninsulaobscura. You can listen to our podcast on most platforms, including Spotify and Apple Podcasts.